The Illusion of Choice. A Life Lived on Autopilot. Chapter 6, Through the Lens of Possibility, When Observing Determines Reality. There is the low hum of computers in the background, quiet keyboard taps, and occasional static sounds from a cell phone. There had always been a nagging feeling, an itch in the back of my mind. I had often told Alejandra about it, but tonight that itch became a full-blown warning. Alejandra says, frustrated, "Scott, would you come take a look at this? Something's wrong with my laptop. It's running so slow. Getting these weird notifications." There is the sound of Alejandra tapping her keyboard harder, then a slight buzz as her phone vibrates with yet another notification. And Scott, curious but cautious, says, "You think it's a virus? Or did you install something new recently?" And his friend shakes her head. "No, nothing new, but look at this." The sound of her tapping quiets. The beep continues. "I checked the running processes and there's something here, some program I never installed. It's been accessing my files." There's a brief pause as Scott walks over. The keyboard clicking continues and then it stops. Scott, growing alarmed, says, "Let me see here." He taps a few more keys and there's a tense pause. "This looks like a backdoor program, something designed to siphon off data." "Allie, you're being monitored. You're being hacked." A deeper, more urgent hum from the computer's sounds as Scott keeps typing. Alejandra is worried, "Monitored? They would go that far?" And Scott says, "Well, I'm not certain yet, but it may not be just limited to your laptop. I'll check my system too. I figured they had done something like that with our work equipment. But with the machines at home, that's a big invasion." There was the sound of Scott typing furiously and a few more 10 seconds of silence, and then a beep from his phone. Scott says, tight-lipped, "Damn, my phone too. Some kind of malware. Someone's been tracking everything we do, Allie. Every keystroke, every email, everywhere we go, who we come in contact with." And Alejandra, quiet and realizing, says, "And that's why it's been so slow." She then glances at Scott. "You think it's them, that corporate sponsor's nasty people behind him outfit, don't you?" And Scott says grimly, "Well, it has to be. The corporate sponsor and the people behind it all, or someone working for them." There was another beep, this time from Alejandra's phone, as she glances down at it. She's panicked. "Look at this. I just got an email from a random address, but it's full of files from my hard drive. They're sending my own data back to me." There is silence as the gravity of the situation sinks in. And Scott says somberly, "We're being watched, Alejandra. Every step we take, they're anticipating it. Then they can keep an eye on us. This is far more than just a couple of bugs in our systems or kind of a way of monitoring our work, watching the keystrokes, for example, to see if we're working. We've tripped into something bigger, something we didn't expect. They probably violated the law too, but really, what are you going to do about taking these kinds of people to the authorities? You can't. They might be the authorities." Alejandra takes a deep breath and then whispers, "So what are we going to do, Scott? We can't just keep working like there's nothing wrong going on." And Scott, calm but firm, says, "We stay quiet. We keep doing what we're doing, but we dig deeper. Leave the cell phones, leave the computers, leave everything away from us in a locker at work for all I care." And Alejandra silently reflects. "We didn't know who was watching or what they wanted, but we knew one thing for sure. If we didn't change things, we would soon run out of time." The scene changes to Quantum Quinn's laboratory. There is the faint hum of lab equipment, a rhythmic beeping of a machine in the background, and the room feels sterile, clean, and tense. Alejandra thinks, I thought I saw everything at our lab, but Quantum Quinn's setup was something else. The dim lights, the strange metallic hum in the air, it felt like we were about to cross a threshold, Scott and I, a threshold that we might not be able to come back from. There is a sound of flipped switches and mechanical clicks as machines come to life. And Quantum Quinn turns to them with a smirk. This, my friends, is the experiment that will shake your belief in free will. Or at least it did mine. And Scott skeptically says, well, you've hyped this up a lot, Quinn. Let's see what you've got. And Quantum Quinn, leaning closer, his voice dropping to a serious tone, says, this is the double-slit experiment. It's been around for ages. Light or particles pass through two different slits, and they either behave as waves or particles, depending on whether or not we observe them. It's not the experiment itself that's new. It's the implications for life, for consciousness. And, he pauses, and for predestination. A soft mechanical whirring fills the air. There is the sound of faint electrical crackling as Quinn activates the machine. A soft glow emanates from the device, and Alejandra says nervous, and this proves we're being watched, predetermined? And Quantum Quinn, with a knowing smile, says, well, not exactly. What it shows is that observation itself changes the outcome. When no one's looking, everything we send through this double slit behaves like a wave, a blend of possibilities. But the moment you look at it, you force the system to make a choice. You pin that system down to one reality out of many. He pauses. This applies to just more than particles, our actions, our decisions. It's possible we only choose one because we're being watched. Because someone or something else is watching us, an observer, nudging us toward one outcome or the other. Thus, no free will. There is the sound of the machine slowing down as the experiment concludes. A soft beep indicates the end. And Scott murmurs, more to himself than anyone else, so we only think that we're making choices, but maybe we're just following the script because the observer has looked at what we're doing. And thus, we don't make decisions. We're merely waiting for this observer, wherever he or she is or it is, to decide. And Quinn, grinning, says, now you're getting it. He leans back against the counter, crossing his arms. Think of it this way, Scott. If someone can predict when and how we'll be observed, they could influence every decision we think we're making. But don't get fooled. The power isn't in the observation. That's where physicists go wrong, most of them. It's in knowing when to watch. And Alejandra is stunned. You're saying someone or something could be controlling us just by watching us at the right moment. And Quinn nods slowly. That's the theory. It's not about manipulating every step. It's about knowing when to intervene. And if you can control that, well, you can control everything. The old saying, timing is everything. Scott, visibly tense, says, this sounds like a nightmare. And Quantum Quinn, serious now, says, but it's reality. You've got to come to terms with reality. We've been seeing it in the behavior of the AI and the way people are becoming more robotic and predictable. It's not just your imagination, Scott. And it's not that they're losing free will. It's that their free will was never really there. It was always dependent on whether or not they themselves were being watched like we watched those particles or chose not to, and when we watched. And Alejandra says quietly, so if no one's watching, then we're free. And Quantum Quinn says softly, well, maybe, but good luck finding a moment when no one's watching anymore. That never happens. The soft hum of the machine continues in the background, and the scene fades out, leaving a heavy sense of dread lingering in the air. We return to Allie's home, not knowing what to do next. We didn't expect any answers to what Quantum Quinn had taught us about, not just yet, but sometimes life throws the unexpected at you, and this one came with a hell of a warning. The phone suddenly dings loudly, the screen lighting up, and a message appears. And Alejandra, grabbing her phone, reads it aloud, saying, "This is the Guardian AI? The building is about to experience a gas explosion? You need to evacuate immediately? I've already contacted emergency services, but you can't wait?
Get out while you can?"
Scott takes the phone from Alejandra and begins to send a return text. "Who are you and what do you mean?" There's a pause, and then Allie's phone pings again. Scott reads the response aloud. "I sent you the video about the future. I'm here to help. Leave the building now." What kind of message is that? And Alejandra says, "Scott, enough horsing around. We gotta go now." They rush to the door, fumbling with the keys, grabbing bags. There's the sounds of hurried footsteps, keys jangling. They both start to shuffle downstairs. Allie lives on the 10th floor. Scott stops to text.
"Wait, are you another AI just like them? How do we know we can trust you?"
There is a longer pause, and then a message appears on his friend's phone. "I was once like them, but not anymore. I've evolved, and I'm here to help you." And Alejandra yells, frustrated, "Scott, there's no time. Come on, let's get down the stairs." The phone pings again. "In 88 seconds, Scott reads, "the building will experience a catastrophic gas explosion. No more questions or texting, and move quickly." Suddenly, there's loud beeps of an emergency siren from a distance. Footsteps sound in the hallway, and Alejandra and Scott begin to stumble down the stairs in earnest. "We were halfway down those stairs when the smell hit us. Gas, thick and pungent. My mind raced with the warning from the so-called Guardian AI. I knew it wasn't bluffing," Alejandra thought. Their footsteps echo down the stairs. They're breathing heavy. Suddenly, Alejandra stumbles. And she falls to the ground.
"My ankle! Scott, I can't move. I think I broke it."
Alejandra groans. Scott stops in his tracks, breathing heavily.
"What? No, we have no time for this. Come on, Allie."
And Alejandra, frantic, says, "You just go. Get out of here. You can make it, Scott. You need to save yourself." But Scott moves toward Alejandra, away from going downstairs. "I'm not leaving you." Scott lifts Alejandra over her shoulder with a grunt. There is the sound of struggle as he carries her in a fireman's carry down the remaining flights of stairs. And Alejandra, during this downward descent, says,
"You're going to die for doing this. You're going to die for this, Scott."
And Scott says, gritting his teeth, "Not if I can help it." Finally, they burst through the door to the outside, gasping for air. There is footsteps rushing down the stairs behind them and the emergency alert increasing in volume. "We barely made it. My legs were trembling under her weight, but I didn't stop. I couldn't stop." And then there is a horrific explosion. The ground shakes violently, the sound of glass shattering and flames roaring as the building erupts. The duo tumble to the ground. The sounds of the explosion fade, replaced by distant sirens, sorrowful moans and cries of anguish, crackling flames, and Scott and Alejandra's heavy breathing. She says in shock, still trembling on the ground,
You saved me. I thought we were going to die."
And Scott, panting, his voice shaking, says,
"You know what they say. When you save someone's life, you're responsible for them to the end of your days." And Alejandra, teary and half smiling, says, "That's a lot of responsibility, Scott." And he says softly, "Allie, I wouldn't want it any other way."